Hello, everybody. This is Peter Ott. Just before we get started, I wanted to make a quick note. While we were recording this episode, I was recording from my house and Sarah was recording from hers. And so, if you pay really close attention, you might be able to hear her dog and my cats in the background. So, apologies for that distraction. I choose to look at it as a benefit, you know, a little flourish that's in there for your entertainment. So, anyway, the interview's great. Sarah had some really interesting things to say, so I think you're all going to enjoy this. So, stay tuned. Thanks. Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Sarah Hartley, a partner in the Denver office of international law firm Brian Cave, practicing in the commercial litigation and antitrust groups. She's head of the firm's outdoor industry team and a member of the sports and entertainment group. Sarah's worked with sports clients in the Olympic movement, professional sports, and collegiate sports, and she is regularly consulted on safe sport matters, governance, and ethical issues. Additionally, she serves as an adjunct professor for a course focusing on governance, sexual misconduct, doping, and other sports topics for the University of Colorado Law School. And most important, she received her JD from the University of Virginia, which is the most important credential a lawyer can have. So good to have you here with us today, Sarah.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
So, I gave a background of some of your credentials and things, but could you get us started maybe letting us know a little bit more about your background, anything interesting, kind of what led you to the place where you are now?
Sure. So I am currently, as you mentioned, a partner at Brian Cave Leighton Paisner in Denver, Colorado. I've had a somewhat circuitous way of getting there, but the common theme throughout has been sports and a passion for sports, not always as the focal point in my career, but certainly an important strand in my life. So I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, and I was an all-around athlete. Ended up playing squash in college at Yale under Mark Talbot, currently the coach at Stanford. But he was a top player in the world for a very long period of time, and he was my first sort of one-on-one exposure to a professional athlete and all of the issues that they face going through the world of sport. After college, I went, as you mentioned, to UVA for law school and had the good fortune after law school to be able to do some work in sports right off the bat. So in my first job right off the bat, I was able to represent the San Diego Chicken, which is more interesting than it sounds. It's the mascot for the San Diego Padres. And so I was able to do a variety of things there, but it was largely intellectual property related. And then when I moved to New York, again, in the intellectual property realm, I represented the Dallas Cowboys and the NFL in defense of the Cowboys America's Team trademark, which was really interesting and really fun and was my first deep dive into professional sports. While I was at Quinn Emanuel, I had the opportunity to touch on some other sports-related stuff, again, mostly IP. Since coming out to Colorado and joining Brian Cave, now Brian Cave, Leighton Paisner, since we went through a merger, I've had the opportunity to work with our Olympic sports practice, which has been pretty broad-based, actually, in what I've been able to do. It's been a range of things from litigation, which is my primary area of practice, to employment agreements, sponsorship agreements, sort of outside general counsel, consulting with sports entities ranging from the U.S. Olympic Committee, national governing bodies, the Pacific Coast League, the Mountain West Conference, other education-related sports conferences or entities. And so that's been a really fun part of my practice. An additional piece of background is that I have also been teaching sports law at the University of Colorado, and that has been probably the most educational bit of my sports practice, really giving me some additional opportunity to delve deeper into topics that are of personal interest and haven't necessarily crossed my desk as a lawyer yet. So that's the high-level background.
Okay, yeah, no, that's That's really interesting. I, you know, lately I've been talking to a lot of people who have been professors of sports law at different institutions, and that's something interesting. I think I want to do a whole episode about that at some point. But yeah, throughout your career, you have a kind of varied experience in different places, different kinds of things. And like you said, you had the opportunity to do some work involving sports right out of law school. Was that always your intention? You know, when you went to law school, were you thinking, oh, I'm going to find some way to bring sports into my practice in the future? Or did that just kind of happen along the way?
So it was never my sole focus. I really didn't know what I wanted to do within the practice of law, but I've always been a passionate sports fan and athlete. And so coming out of school, when the opportunities arose to work with partners who were doing sports-related work, that was always a really easy sell for me. You know, when I represented NFL teams, my husband got really excited because it meant we got to watch NFL games on the weekend, and I could pretend like I was, you know, doing diligence for work. So for me, it's been something that it has been very, very appealing along the way, but I wouldn't say it's been my sole focus. It's been something that I've been lucky enough to be able to get myself into wherever I've been.
Okay. And you do other things that don't involve sports clients as well. So sometimes, you know, I've talked to people who say, you know, you think it's going to be exciting to work in sports law, but it's just the same thing, or in some ways it can even kind of tarnish the veneer that you have that makes sports seem, you know, sexy or cool or whatever. Has that been your experience? Is it just another thing, or do you find particular enjoyment in doing sports law work?
So I would say that my answer is probably twofold. Sports entities, whether they're professional sports or Olympic sports, they're all businesses with business issues. So in that sense, it's all very similar to the other work I do, which is, you know, complex commercial and antitrust litigation. That being said, I think that most of us are more excited to get up for work every day if we're passionate about the subject matter of what we're doing. And so while seeing under that, you know, sexy veneer, if you will, is sometimes disappointing, these are businesses. And so you get to see how they work and operate and get to know the people who are involved, the athletes, the coaches, the supervisors, the governance teams. And that for me is very exciting. And it's not all that different than what I do for other clients. But, you know, then being able to go cheer on the team when they're on TV for the Olympics, or, you know, on the field at a local football game, that for me makes it more real and more exciting.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, thanks for sharing that. So let's go forward and talk about the specific kind of work you do. You're located in Denver, which is convenient for the USOC. Can you talk to us about just in general the kind of work you do with them and for them?
Sure. So I have done pretty much exclusively safe sport related work for the Olympic Committee, and that is fairly narrow, though very high profile for what they're dealing with now. Our firm has done a much broader range of work with them as outside counsel over the years. But my practice in particular has been helping them create and develop the rules and procedures for the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, which came online in March of 2017. So I was working with the in-house lawyers and the ethics and integrity folks at the USOC to help them develop the structure, plan for, and then actually lay out the framework for the Center for Safe Sport to help process claims and allegations of misconduct within sport.
Okay, yeah, no, and I think this is really interesting because that's the kind of work that as a practicing lawyer, you don't, at least I don't think of as the typical day-to-day work that a lawyer does, you know, actually building up a system, a set of rules and procedures. And so I guess let's back up a little and talk about what exactly is the purpose of Safe Sport, the Center for Safe Sport, and then what's involved in that work of putting together rules and regulations for them.
So Safe Sport is actually an internationally used term to describe child safeguarding. It is used within the U.S. Olympic movement to talk about the programs and policies adopted and implemented by the Olympic movement to protect athletes from misconduct by others involved in sport. That could be the coach, a trainer, a doctor, a parent who's on a team trip. And so back in 2012, safe sport policies were adopted across the national governing bodies, and each national governing body on its own had to make sure their policies were compliant with the USOC's framework and then actually implement those policies on the ground. And the way that worked was that if an athlete suffered some type of misconduct, they could file a complaint with their national governing body. And because of the Ted Stevens Amateur and Olympic Sports Act, if that claim impacts the respondent, essentially the defendant's ability to compete or to participate in sport, you have a hearing. And so these are disciplinary hearings within the national governing body itself. It's a membership organization. And so those disciplinary proceedings are held to determine if it's more likely than not that the misconduct occurred or a violation of the rules occurred. And this is the same type of hearing that you would have for any type of violation of the governance, bylaws, codes of conduct of the organization. So for safe sport, you have these hearings and an opportunity to present your evidence. The other side has an opportunity to present their defense. And then ultimately, a panel decides whether or not they believe a violation has occurred. So that is how it worked. And it was internal to the national governing body because it was an internal disciplinary proceeding. And I know that's taken some heat because of a perceived lack of independence. And that ultimately is what led to the creation of the U.S. Center for Safe Sport. Safe Sport being an overarching program that was for the entire Olympic movement is now housed in a separate body, the U.S. Center for Safe Sport, which now has taken over responsibility for all of the sexual-related misconduct that occurs within the Olympic movement. So instead of reporting to your NGB, your national governing body, and having the national governing body handle the disciplinary proceeding, all of that is now housed with and handled by the center. So the national governing body is now sort of, I don't want to say out of the picture entirely, because that's never truly the case. They might have to present evidence. They might be involved in some way, shape, or form, and certainly will be involved in implementing any sanction, suspension, or expulsion from sport. But the actual investigation, hearing of the complaint, and decision-making is all done separate and apart. So that is what the center does. It's been online for about a year and a half now.
Okay. So this center exists for investigating these, you know, allegations, and then they some kind of panel then gives findings, and you know, say they find that there was, you know, some kind of assault or incident. So then what's the process from there? Then they inform the national governing body, and the national governing body is encouraged to, you know, exclude the offender from participation in the future? Is that how the enforcement works?
No, not exactly. So as a condition of being a recognized national governing body, each NGB has to accept the authority and jurisdiction of the U.S. Center for Safe Sport over these types of claims, the sexual misconduct claims. Some of them can be relatively minor. Some of them can be really egregious. All of them are bad, but there are a range, as in criminal law, a range of different types of offenses that you can have. And so a range of different types of punishments or sanctions that will be found applicable by the center's hearing officer. There's an opportunity for an appeal to an arbitration panel. I believe it still is only one of the parties, the respondent, if the respondent disputes the result. But that's been in flux. But all the rules, all the arbitration procedures are available at safesport.org. So you can find all of that there. But to the extent that there is a finding of a violation and a sanction is issued, it is mandatory for each national governing body to implement it. And it is uniformly applied across all Olympic sports. So it used to be that you could have a triathlon coach who was suspended or expelled, but they could go be a track coach or a swim coach or a cycling coach because there wasn't necessarily reciprocity of enforcement across the whole movement. And so that has now changed. And if somebody has been sanctioned for violating the Safe Sport Code, their name is now part of a publicly available database so that anybody who is looking to hire this person can find their name on there. Anybody who's looking to identify potential issues with their coaches and the staff with whom their athlete will be interacting can find that information there.
Okay. And the universe of affected athletes and organizations is the U.S. Olympic, the various U.S. Olympic sports, right? This doesn't impact, you know, AAU basketball or something like that. Is that correct?
So not directly. I had a case that received a lot of publicity over the last year in volleyball. And one of the big concerns was that the coach was expelled by USA Volleyball. And were these other organizations, in volleyball, it was the AAU and the Junior Volleyball Association, I believe, the JVA. They didn't immediately and automatically expel this coach from their organizations. And so there had to be pressure exerted to make them do that. But the Olympic movement and the center have no jurisdiction over anybody other than the organizations that are within the Olympic movement. So it's a question of resources, quite frankly, and right. It being focused on the Olympics. It is clearly a broader cultural issue, all of the misconduct that we have and all of the sexual harassment. It's not just in sport. It's a very broad-based issue that we need a huge social change to address. Obviously, in sports, it's become a bigger issue because coaches have so much contact with their athletes and they have a lot of opportunity, sort of in the same way that we saw a lot of incidents within the church and the Boy Scouts. There is a systemic problem, but it's not limited to sport, but it's very obviously prominent in the press right now.
Right. Okay. So yeah, Safe Sport is addressing this issue at the Olympic level. And yeah, like you say, it's a widespread problem throughout, you know, not just sports, but the whole world. And I guess another question that comes to mind, speaking about the universe of people affected, you know, obviously sexual assault, sexual misconduct, those are also criminal offenses. And so how does Safe Sport, arbitrations or decisions, how do those interact with the criminal law world? Can those be used as evidence or is there any interplay there at all or is it completely separate?
So the proceedings themselves are separate. You know, the criminal system works on its own and sort of irrespective of whatever's happening within the Center for Safe Sport. But I handled a lot of disciplinary cases for NGBs over the years, and the easiest cases for us to easily get somebody out of sport were those where there were criminal charges. That is the slam dunk, right? You have a higher standard, higher burden of proof in a criminal case. It has to be beyond a reasonable doubt, right, that you have committed a crime. And so that is a higher threshold than within the Olympic sports movement. It's just a preponderance of the evidence, more likely than not. And so if you have a criminal conviction, that's a really easy thing. And that respondent is almost not going to bother with defending him or herself in the process within the Olympic movement because the criminal conviction will be dispositive.
Right. Okay. So that's usually the way it works is that a criminal conviction would be such overwhelming evidence that it would affect the disciplinary action through Safe Sport rather than the other way around.
Right. And there's often cooperation between the folks within the Safe Sport investigative team and the criminal investigators. We often had to sort of back off on certain things because the district attorney or the U.S. attorney was handling things. And that obviously is something that has been a focal point in some of these big high profile cases. You know, who should be handling what when there's a criminal investigation ongoing, but there are ways that Safe Sport handles that pending criminal investigation if they can't immediately, you know, start investigating by interviewing witnesses and doing whatnot because those witnesses are the subject of criminal inquiries. There are interim measures that can be taken to make sure athletes and the community are protected while things are pending.
Well, yeah, thanks for giving me some feedback on that. That's interesting. And so you helped come up with the rules and procedures for this, and then it sounds like you're involved on an ongoing basis as well. So what are you doing on an ongoing basis with Safe Sport?
So my role has changed quite significantly. Before we got the center up and running, I was helping develop the rules and procedures for the organization. Now, those of us who had been involved at the front end are not involved anymore with the center. It is independent of the USOC and the lawyers who were engaged before. They have independent counsel now and are separate and apart from the U.S. Olympic Committee. But what I have done a lot of in the wake of the center coming online is help different national governing bodies rework their procedures, their internal governance documents to make sure they're compliant with the new requirements that they have as a result of the center coming online. So they no longer handle those sexual misconduct claims within the organization. And so you have to rework your bylaws and your disciplinary guidelines to reflect that all of those have to be passed over. All of the claims and allegations that come in have to be reported both to the center and to law enforcement. You know, there's a lot of change that had to happen there. And then, sort of at the very front end of the center coming online, there were still some pending cases where the national governing body was already in the process of handling the disciplinary proceedings, and some of those were not handed over to the center, and I helped sort of close those out, get the sanctions imposed, and then move on from there.
Well, good. Yeah, no, that's... It's interesting, obviously with any kind of negative action, but certainly with the sexual misconduct, it's important that there's systems set up that people can have good faith in, and that the administrative side avoids even the appearance of, some kind of conflict. So thanks for explaining that. That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so as we're getting close to finishing up here, another thing I wanted to talk about, I know, like you said, Safe Sport has been up and running for a little over a year now, and there's been some criticism of Safe Sport. A past guest on the Sports Law Biz podcast, Nancy Hogshead McCarr, and some other people have criticized Safe Sport, and the argument is that it's not effective at protecting athletes. One criticism that I've seen is that the materials encourage athletes to implicitly trust their coaches, which could create a kind of predatory mindset. I'm sure you're aware of criticisms like that. Do you have a response to those kind of criticisms, and are you aware of anything being done to address these concerns?
I am aware of the criticisms, and yes, I'm aware of things being done to address them. But what I would say at the front end is that I think the people who are involved in Safe Sport sort of at the upper levels and then within each of the national governing bodies, these are people who care immensely for the safety and well-being of their athletes and are doing their best to develop policies and procedures to protect their athletes and those other people who are within their organization. So with that as background, I think, anybody would be willing to admit that one incident of misconduct is too much. So obviously, if we are having ongoing issues, the system is not as effective as we want it to be. So I think with the new legislation that I know Nancy was involved in, there are some additional oversight requirements and reporting requirements that are now being mandated while they were being voluntarily engaged in by the NGBs previously. So I think on that end, that's an improvement. On the training materials, I think I would probably just beg to differ that they are instructing athletes to trust their coaches and the people around them without question. I think that the rules that we have helped national governing bodies adopt and implement are pretty clear that certain types of behavior are inappropriate and unacceptable. And the unfortunate reality is that a lot of the athletes who are targeted are young, and maybe they don't read the materials thoroughly or they don't understand them or whatnot. So more can be done, more should be done to help athletes really understand what is appropriate and inappropriate behavior. But I think, again, a lot of the challenge here is that parents inherently trust coaches and trainers and leave their children with people without really doing any diligence. And I think there's a lot more that can be done on the parent side to make sure that they are really requiring their sports environments to be safe and healthy, and when there are suspicions that a coach has been engaged in misconduct or, you know, outside the Olympic movement, a lot of these coaches go and they now get a job at your local country club or the AAU. You know, I think if people speak out and say, you know what, this coach might help my kid get a college scholarship, but he or she is a predator and I'm not going to put my kid there. I think that's the first step. You know, I would advise parents to do what they can to understand the risks associated with the people who they are coaching. You know, I've got a kid who is going into climbing and baseball and whatnot. And I look up every person's name who he interacts with in sport before I agree to go to that organization. I would say everybody should do that. It's unfortunate. It's really sad that we have to do that. But I would say that it's just a matter of taking your own steps and your own precautions to ensure your children are safe. All of that sort of tied up, I think we all have to work harder within the movement, take advice from people who are without the movement, and do whatever we can within the Olympic movement in particular to make our athletes safe. And I think that's something that the USOC is really focused on right now. They announced a working group on a lot of the oversight and supervisory questions on sort of what role the U.S. Olympic Committee plays in respect to the national governing bodies. And I think we'll see some change and a lot of progress over the years to come.
Yeah, no, and you know, obviously these issues are complicated. We as a society are struggling with how to deal with these, you know, sexual misconduct cases. And you know, it's clear that a lot needs to be done to correct our culture and things like that. And so, you know, Safe Sport, you know, based on our discussion today, I think it's clear that Safe Sport is kind of a tool in the tool chest to help deal with that. But, you know, a lot of things need to be happening, and hopefully all the different stakeholders, whether that's the organizations themselves, you know, parents, athletes themselves, you know, politicians, hopefully everybody can work together to create a better system and a better culture that we're living in. So
amen to that.
So yeah, no, that's I know that I've learned a lot today. That has really filled in a lot of gaps in my understanding of what Safe Sport was. So thanks for that. Is there anything else you'd like to kind of get off your chest before we wrap up here?
Nothing to get off my chest per se, but you know, for you, Peter, and for others who might be interested in teaching sports law, I would say go for it. You know, for me, it's given me the opportunity to touch on subjects that I really wouldn't have seen otherwise. And it's given me an opportunity to write about the subjects that are of interest to me and really be part of the dialogue. And I've got to say, having spent as much time as I have as a professional thinking about these things, getting a young student's insight gives a whole new level of perspective and objectivity that a lot of us who are working in the weeds don't necessarily see. So, you know, I take that more broadly to suggest to all folks who are involved in safe sport or other types of sports integrity work, you know, be willing to consider what other people are saying and some of the seemingly outlandish bits of advice or creative thoughts that they have for you, because every now and then something comes out of the discussions that you're having in your classroom or just with friends at a, you know, a happy hour, that it's really, really helpful to think about those outside perspectives, and it can really help you develop a strategy for making meaningful change.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, that's good advice. So, so thanks for that. And, thanks for coming on the Sports Law Biz podcast, and we hope to speak to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIB Montoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, at PeterJOTT, through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, at SportsLawBiz, or through email at SportsLawBizBlog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I know I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.